The First World War started in Europe on 28th June 1914. A Bosnian Serb student assassinated Archbishop Ferdinand and his wife Sophie in Sarajevo, hoping to end the Austria-Hungary's rule over Bosnia-Herzegovina. Exactly 1 month later, as a punishment and retaliation for this assassination, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia for not controlling sub-statal actors and terrorist activities in their territory. I'm sure it reminds us of lots of recent events where great powers have intervened in the affairs of other countries in the pretext that they do not control terrorists in their midst, Afghanistan being one of them. Anyway, a series of alliances and treaties as a result of this declaration of war, a series of alliances and treaties brought several countries into the war, such as Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, and Russia. And because these countries were empires, they inevitably brought with them the rest of the world. In those days, the great empires controlled 84% of the world's population. And therefore, the war, which was largely European in its provenance and European in its concerns, became a world war. Well, when the war began, Britain was in no position to fight on its own and drew upon the countries of the Commonwealth for its military support. India, of course, I mean, lots of countries from the Commonwealth supported Britain, sent soldiers. India contributed most generously, and its contribution was greater than that of the rest of the Commonwealth put together. And what I shall do for the next 5 minutes, boring as it may seem, is to itemize the Indian contribution to give you some idea of the scale and magnitude of what Indian contribution was. And it was a contribution at various levels. India contributed around 1.5 million volunteers for the war effort. Active soldiers. Out of 1.5 million, 50,000 died. 65,000 were badly wounded. 10,000 were reported missing. They fought bravely and won 13,000 medals, including 12 Victoria Crosses, which are given for the highest acts of courage. So this is one level of contribution. They also contributed at the civilian level, including doctors, nurses, storekeepers, clerks, cooks, the entire retinue of staff that is needed to keep the administrative machinery going. And in all, about 200 army nurses were killed during the war, and about 98 were Indian. The third level of contribution was in terms of animals. 170,000 animals were supplied because they were needed for war in Mesopotamia and in other parts, such as horses, ponies, mules, camels. Without them, the war could not simply have been fought. They also contributed the equipment needed for military warfare, which included 550 million bullets, 1 million shells, and 146,000 rifles. All this and the salaries of the soldiers paid for by the Indian taxpayer. They also provided a large amount of goods, raw material that was needed for the war. In all, it amounted to 3.7 million tons of supplies, which included jute for the sandbags, wheat and rice for feeding the army, and also for feeding the British people, because they were short of these things. They also raised the loan, running into today's price, today's rate, approximately £2 billion. And as I said earlier, for almost all of this, it was the Indian taxpayer who funded it. They fought in almost all the major theaters of war, such as France, Belgium, Mesopotamia, and Egypt. In France, and I'll say something about that because that has some fascinating history, 136,000 Indians fought on in France and Belgium together, what is called the Western Front. 650,000 Indian soldiers fought in Mesopotamia, and 144,000 in Egypt. Now, Britain in those days had no standing army, and therefore it sent what is called the British Expeditionary Force to France. Now, that small, not very well-equipped force was no match for the Germans, and Britain immediately turned to India in the first few weeks of the war, asking for help. Now, Indians came, as I said, in fairly large number, about 50,000 in the first batch, and then during the course of the war installments. And in the first few weeks, they lost nearly 50% of their soldiers. And that was so for a variety of reasons. After 1857, call it rebellion or call it mutiny, Britain had systematically followed a policy. It was afraid of the Indian army, and therefore had followed a policy of keeping the Indian army one generation behind in its weaponry. And when, therefore, they were brought to France, they were not trained at all for the modern weaponry, and they had to be trained, they had to be equipped, and all that took time, which was not available, and therefore, on an earlier generation of weaponization, they took on the Germans, and the result, heavy casualties. It was also the case that many of them were not prepared for the war was in October, November, when they came here, and many of them were not prepared for the cold climate. They were not prepared for the food either, and no preparations had been made to take that into account. So for all these reasons, a large number of them died in the first few weeks. But while they died and fought with great courage, and I'll talk about that in a minute, it is also worth remembering that although they were one generation behind in their weaponization, they also brought with them certain skills which the British military forces did not have, especially the skill or the art of patrolling in a form that is suited to trench warfare. Indian soldiers knew that because of their skirmishes in the Himalayas, and they were able to bring with them those skills and therefore help the British soldiers. And thanks to all this, they fought not only on all the fronts, but they fought in all the important battles of the First World War, such as Givenchy, Neuchâtel, Festubert, and Loos. During the war, there was also quite part of the reason why many of them felt frustrated and suffered heavy losses was that they were badly led. When in the first round, as I said, the British Expeditionary Force was no match, and Indians were one generation behind, when they lost their officers, new officers were brought in to lead them, and these officers had no knowledge of any of the Indian languages, and therefore communication often broke down, and there were no clear instructions given to them. That's broadly what happened during the war. There were charges, especially the German propaganda, that Indian and particularly African soldiers in France and Belgium were accused of brutality and violation of international law. And the German propaganda said that these soldiers, Indian and African, were particularly fond of hunting, and I quote, particularly fond of hunting for trophy by cutting off fingers, hands, and heads of their victims. Investigation at the time and subsequent research has shown that there was no truth in this, except in the minimal sense that some of the African soldiers who came brought with them this practice, very small percentage, practice of taking the head of the enemy with them. So there was some degree of brutality in this form, but no Indian soldiers were involved. There was also the charge that Indian soldiers in some cases shot themselves in order to be taken out of action. Well, this did happen in the early years, to a very small extent, but it did happen to a small extent, not because they lacked courage, but because they felt that they had been very badly treated and they had not been properly trained. And this was more in frustration and anger rather than cowardice. And as in any kind of war, there are desertions from the front line, and there were desertions, but they were extremely limited. We have no figures available. I have checked and checked, and I can't find how many Indians deserted the army during the war. But I'm told that the number is extremely small. And generally, when desertions took place, this was not for lack of courage, largely out of personal grievances, such as, for example, being overlooked for promotion, or because of the inclement climate, and they felt that they had not been properly warned, properly trained, properly equipped, and therefore they were not going to fight, a kind of protest. And most of the people from India who deserted, small amount, but still, who deserted their positions, were Pathans, who knew that they had absolutely nothing to fear by way of consequences, because their homeland was outside the British jurisdiction. Well, those who were wounded during the war were looked after, as you know, in Brighton Pavilion, which was transformed into a hospital. It could take only the Royal Pavilion, which could only take about 600 people, and then there were lots of other buildings which were requisitioned and turned into hospitals where wounded Indian soldiers from the Western Front were brought and looked after. And it's very striking that given the pattern of British rule in India, even in these hospitals, two basic rules were practices were systematically followed. One, religious and caste rules were systematically observed. If a soldier was a Brahmin, and very few of them were there, or high caste, he was looked after by a high caste cook. There was also the racist element, which is that no female white nurses were allowed to look after the wounded Indian or African soldiers, but I'm talking about the Indian one, wounded Indian soldiers, because that distance had to be kept. It was kept in India, and they didn't want Indian soldiers to get into the habit of thinking that white women were available to them here, in case it has the similar consequences in India. They were well looked after, by and large, despite these two rules. They wrote very movingly to their families about how well they were looked after and how the British followed the practice of equal treatment here, although they had not done so in India. But they always complained about one restriction, and that is that the colonial government was afraid that the soldiers might either disappear into British society, or get to know the British people closely, or form liaisons with British women, and therefore they were kept behind barbed wires and not allowed to go into the city unchaperoned. So in all their correspondence, they always talked about enjoying reasonable degree of equality, excepting the racial inequality that I talked about, but the absence of freedom. Well, that's broadly the story, the horrible story of the war, the wounded, who fought where. Who were these people? There's 1.5 million people. Who were they? Where did they come from? And why did they join the army during the war? Well, they mostly came from a large number of areas in India, but mostly from the Punjab. They were Muslims and Sikhs, by and large, about 80% of them. And Hindus amounted to about 20 to 22%. Punjab contributed the largest number. About 500,000 soldiers came from the Punjab. From UP, there were 281,000. Maharashtra contributed 71,000. Madras, 92,000. Bihar, 42,000. And in this way, the figures go on. Why did they come? Why did they volunteer? Because this was not an army of conscripts. This was a voluntary army. Why did they join the army? Well, there were several reasons, some obvious, some not so obvious. First, of course, it brought money. If you joined the army, many of them were farmers in Punjab, Jats, same thing in UP, and this provided an additional and rather lucrative source of income. Second, many of them, when they were interviewed, said izzat, that it made them kshatriyas. Fighting was the profession of the kshatriyas. And in a caste-ridden society such as ours, if you were able to say, look, I am a soldier, I fight, your social status rises because you are a Kshatriya. It also brings you and your family certain prestige because you fought for the empire, you fought in the war, you went to Europe. So partly to increase the social status of your family, partly to improve your caste status, and partly, of course, to increase the reputation of your family and naturally of the subsequent generations. Many of them were also already used to be going abroad as part of colonial expeditions, which were conducted by the colonial rulers. I mean, they went to Afghanistan, they went to other parts, and many of them were sometimes taken. So there was already a tradition of being part, of either as conscripts or as voluntary soldiers in colonial expedition. There was also, and this may not surprise many of us, although it did surprise me when I first read this, there was also this enormous sense of loyalty to the king. Not to the empire, because empire is an abstraction. They were saying, look, we live under the rule of His Majesty, and therefore, just as we have traditionally obeyed and given our loyalty to the king, we should do the same here. And therefore, intense sense of loyalty to the king. And also, this may surprise some, that these people coming from villages, they were very anxious, perhaps, I mean, I don't know the full history, but badly treated, looked down upon, and they wanted to prove to the Europeans that when it came to fighting or when it came to dying, they were in no way inferior to the British, to the rulers. So part of the reason for joining was to prove their mettle and to establish their equality with the Europeans. And it's very striking in this context that even someone like Mahatma Gandhi supported the First War, and not only that, but in 1916-17 went about recruiting soldiers for the First World War. And for a man who was committed to non-violence, this, and who had not fought in any of the Anglo-Boer wars in South Africa, and only joined this and supported the war through ambulance corps, it was very striking that he decided to raise troops. Didn't succeed, collected only about 95 people from Kheda, starting with himself as the first person and Vallabhbhai Patel as the second. So it turned out to be a fiasco, but the point is that he himself supported the war. And it's interesting to explore why he did so when he was already committed to nonviolence. And he gave four reasons. He was not always consistent in his reasoning, but he gave four reasons. First, he was convinced that this will facilitate independence. Because if Indians fought for the Raj, then it becomes legitimate for them after the war is over to ask for greater degree of independence. Secondly, he said, look, we have enjoyed the benefits of the empire, and therefore we owe it to the empire to return. Jiski roti khai hai, I mean, we have benefited from them, and therefore we must reciprocate. His third reason was that the war was fought in the name of freedom, and it is therefore important that Indians as freedom-seeking people ought to support a side which was committed to freedom. And most importantly for him, or not most important, but one of the most important reasons for him was a very complex one. He said, Indians, he said, in all the campaigns that he had led, campaigns of Satyagraha in South Africa and some movements in India, were cowards. And their non-violence was the non-violence of cowards. It was not the non-violence of courage. A truly non-violent person can only be one who has the courage, who is prepared to kill, because it is only he who is prepared to kill is also likely to be someone who is prepared to die. And he thought that what the war would do is to train Indians into the art of defending themselves, develop their courage, and therefore make them proud and therefore fit for Satyagraha and the practice of non-violence. So this kind of support the war enjoyed in India, not surprisingly, people, for half a dozen reasons that I have mentioned, people volunteer themselves for the war in large numbers. Question now that I want briefly to turn to is, what were their experiences during the war? their experiences, their reactions are recorded or reflected in the letters that they wrote to their families. Now, sadly, or perhaps understandably, these letters are not available to us because they were subject to military censors. And if somehow these letters did really reach their families, it is the families in the Punjab and UP which might have those letters, and I don't think the government of India has shown any interest in collecting the archives of these letters. But so far as our sources here are concerned, what we have are not those letters themselves, but these letters were abstracted, summarized by the military censors. And these are available to us. And a colleague of mine in my own university, about a few years ago, published a book, which I think is quite striking, a man called David Omise, and the book is called Indian Voices of the Great War. And in those letters, which are very revealing, one gets, and most of them written by Indians on the Western Front, mainly in France and Belgium. Indians in Mesopotamia and other Egypt and other places, we have no idea of what letters they wrote to their families, what their experiences were. But we do have a fairly good idea of what those in France and Belgium felt and wrote. And these letters make fascinating reading. Many of these people couldn't write. They were illiterate. And therefore what they did was to dictate their letters either to a white officer or to somebody, one of their own. And that man added his own little bit to the letter, as we all know happens in India. I mean, my mother couldn't write, for example, when I first came to England. She would dictate the letter to somebody else, and I would invariably see that some of the bits in it was added by this chap and not coming straight from my mother. So they added stuff of their own. Military censors sometimes added some stuff because they wanted to make sure that no bad reports about the war reached India because your future recruitment would stop. But these soldiers were not gullible fools. They knew all this. They knew that a military censor was censoring their letters. They knew that the chap they dictated to was interfering with their letters. So they invented a coded language of their own. And the coded language makes absolutely fascinating reading. Let me just give you one example. It was, as I said earlier, because of very poor leadership in the early years, lots of people died who shouldn't have died, or Indians died in larger number than the whites because they were not properly trained. They were one generation lower in weaponization. How do you convey this to your family? So they invented a phrase. And let me just mention one or two. They wouldn't say, we Indians have been badly treated or we Indians are being sacrificed far more than the white soldiers. You couldn't do that. And if you did, the military censor would take it out. So they said there is too great, and now this is a quotation from one letter, so I'll give you two to give you some idea. One of the letters said, there is too great an expenditure of black and red pepper. We enjoy omelette, we enjoy our food, but there is too much of expenditure on black and red pepper. Black is us, red is the British. The language is also quite important. To call to talk about whites comes much later. In those days, the Europeans were often referred to not so much as whites, but as reds. I mean, you can take your pick. You can call them pinks or any other color. But I'm surprised that the Indians refer to themselves as black paper because the black is not a color. Indians are racist in their own way. And black is not the color that they would normally use to describe themselves. But they evidently did because they had no choice. The paper can be either black or red. Red is chilly. They couldn't say brown paper because they'll be caught. So they said huge expenditure of black and red paper, which means ordinary soldiers are being sacrificed without much forethought. Or if they want to say that we are the first to be sent and killed, the second quotation, black paper is used up first and quickly. And there is an increasing shortage of black paper because it is being used up first. So, which is a way of saying we are being used as cannon fodder. These letters are also important not only because of the shrewdness of an Indian villager who in his own way was trying to outsmart the British system of surveillance and censorship. These letters from the Western Front also give you some idea, and a fascinating idea, of what these people who had never seen Europe, never been out of India before, suddenly find themselves in France, not very far from Paris. What were their impressions? Their impressions of French way of life, French pattern of social relations, streets, cleanliness. What did they learn from it? And it's very striking that in these letters they commented very favorably on the French houses, French spirit of equality, treatment of women. But it is also striking that they were just as critical. They were not bowled over. And they were critical for purely selfish reasons. Many of them, because they had been in France for quite a while, built up liaisons with French women. And without being too explicit before this distinguished audience, they had their affairs, they had physical contacts, they picked up certain ways of doing things, and they started passing on information of that way of doing things to their folks back home. One letter will tell you what is happening. One Punjabi soldier writes to his wife, "The ladies here are very nice. And bestow their favors upon us freely and most generously." So that tells you something. But then he can't stop there, and I'm not going to read the whole of the rest of this sentence at the risk of being misunderstood. But he says, they don't do this thing the way we do in India. Now, what is interesting here, and I think some work needs to be done, I hope I'll have one PhD student ready to do work on this, how knowledge about sexual techniques or sexual performance is quietly passed on from one civilization to another. Now, these soldiers who were sleeping with French women, who were accustomed to certain ways of doing things, which they picked up and told their wives, this is how the Europeans do it, why don't you do that too? But also in the process telling French women, our women do it this way, why don't you do it this way too? So I can tell you that there has been interracial mixing, and there is a great deal of exchange of very confidential knowledge and techniques and information, thanks to these soldiers. Well, that's broadly their letters. Their letters also tell us lots about other things, their relations with officers, their thoughts on the empire. More important, and that is what I want to say something about, when they return to India, because I have so far talked about Indian contribution to the First World War, but what is the First World War's contribution to India? Just as important. And India profoundly changed as a result of the First World War, partly thanks to these Indian soldiers. When they went back after several years on the Western Front and here, they took with them several ideas. And they pressed them in India. First thing they took with them was demand for political freedom. We have seen what a free society like France or a free country like England could be. Why should we be a nation of slaves? Why can't we be free in exactly the same way? And this is something that happens in 1617. These people go back in 1918, which is roughly when the Mahatma starts his Satyagraha and the campaign for mobilization for Indian independence. So you already had a large number of people, hundreds of thousands, who had already tasted life in a free society and were pressing for it. Secondly, they had seen prosperity, affluence in Europe, compared it to the depressed conditions in India, depressed was the word they frequently used, and said, why should India be economically so poor? And the explanation was because of colonialism, and therefore once again it fed into a demand for freedom. Thirdly, and very importantly, they began to emphasize the value of education. They said, Europeans have advanced so far because everyone there is educated. Sadly, we are not. And they also began to realize that they would have profited far more from the war and their stay in France and elsewhere if they had been educated. Just as important, they had proved, and as several letters make clear, but also on their return, their demands make clear, they had proved that they were just as brave, just as clever as the Europeans. And therefore, the old racist idea that Indians were somehow inferior almost disappeared. We are just as good as you, we are equal to you in matters involving life and death, and not only that we can fight as well as you, but we can plan, we can plot, we can strategize, we can even tell you a few techniques such as the art of patrolling in trench warfare. As a result of all that, they developed a profound sense of not only their own dignity, but the idea of equality. They had seen Europe in its glory, but they had also seen Europe in its sordidness, the casual way in which lots of people were sent to the death. And therefore, they developed a highly sympathetic but also critical attitude to the European civilization. That this civilization has its virtues, has its strengths, but it also has its darker side. And obviously, as they went back, they asked their officers, they asked the colonial government to give them equal pay and look after them just as well as they had been looked after in Britain. In other words, demand for higher pay and better conditions. So that's broadly, I think, what the First World War did to India. At some point, if there was an occasion, I would have loved to concentrate on it. But I should stop there, and I want, in the next 3 or 4 minutes, what I want to do is to draw the whole discussion to a close. What follows from what I have said, and why is the Indian contribution to the First World War a matter for remembering, commemorating, celebrating? First, in lots of history books, until recently, the Indian contribution has seen as a kind of marginal footnote, that they came and a few of them fought. That is just not true. 1.5 million people is not a small number, and 50,000 dead is not a small sacrifice. And not just look at the number of people who died, look at the amount of money, look at the amount of supplies of all sorts of things. And the amount, the Indian contribution was simply colossal. That's the first thing to bear in mind. Secondly, in Britain, this has been treated largely as marginal. But to my surprise, perhaps it shouldn't be to my surprise, it has been neglected in India as well. One would have thought that Indian historians would have highlighted the Indian contribution to the First World War, that there might have been some monuments in India commemorating the contribution their soldiers or their people had made to the First World War. That hasn't happened. I mean, the colonial government has this India Gate in Delhi, which initially for the First World War, but then became a symbol for all the wars. But beyond that, neither the post-independence government, no post-independence government, has thought it necessary to commemorate the Indian contribution to the First World War, let alone the Second. Why is that? I'm not entirely sure. I think partly, especially when even someone like Gandhi had said that this war was worth fighting and had encouraged people to join. So it was not that these soldiers were seen as traitors who were shoring up the empire and therefore hated. They were engaged in a war which was blessed by the father of the nation himself. Why then no attempt to commemorate? I think partly because Indian historians, by and large, have no interest in military history. That's one. And partly because I think there is a tendency to see that these soldiers went there to make money. Why should the country remember them? As individuals, they were not sent by the country. They didn't die for the country. And therefore, there is no reason why the country collectively should remember them. I'm not sure what the reasons are. But, Ghulam, I think this is an issue which I think at some point we should take up. That just as we are pressing for the British recognition of the Indian contribution to the First World War, I think we should also be asking the Indian government, but not here, but there, the Indian government to recognize the contribution. And also, as I said earlier, the First World War's contribution to India. The third conclusion I draw is that it is quite important to recognize and celebrate, in some way, the Indian contribution to the First World War for two reasons in Britain. First, I think it makes British people realize what they owe to Indians, that their history was not enacted just by them, that in their history, we also played a role, that their liberty is an achievement of not only what they have done, but also what others have done. And I think if one went further back in history, if you look at the post-Napoleonic Wars, again, you will see the Arabs and the Indians and others and blacks played an important role. That throughout Britain's history, blacks and browns and others have played an important role, and therefore we are as much a part of British history, as much architects of British history, as the British people themselves. And I think that recognition must be made, partly because it is true, and partly because it helps cement a multicultural society. And conversely, I think this is also important for the Indians here to recognize that our history here didn't begin in 1949 or 59, whenever we first came. That we have been present here in one form or another for several hundred years, if one goes back further into the past, but certainly First World War. And there are people here even today, the children, the grandchildren, and the great-grandchildren of those who fought in the First World War. And I think somebody's trying to prepare a list of those people. It's these soldiers who were wounded in Brighton, looked after in Brighton, either they stayed on, married, and their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren are still here, or they went back, but came back, or they went back, didn't come back, but their children came back after independence. So our presence here, and I has been here in one form or another since after the First World War. And I think it is good for Indians here to realize that we have that we are part of this history, that Britain's history is ours. And I think what it does is to bond, is to create deeper bonds of collective memory, of mutual gratitude, which is why I think an event like this becomes extremely significant. It's not only a historically important event, because it recognizes the truth of history, it is also a politically significant event, because it helps bond a society in terms of shared memories by emphasizing how many the minorities are not simply, have not been here only for the last 10 or 15 years, they've been an integral part of British history.